we are talking about the early American colonies. Last time we talked about the planting of and the spread of Christianity in Latin America. So, of course, Columbus discovered the West Indies in 1492, and throughout most of the 1500s, the Protestants were pretty badly placed to really do anything in the New World. They were various problems in various places, war and conflict and. Or just kind of being behind the times in terms of recognizing the potential that was there. So you didn't see a whole lot of activity on the part of any Protestant nations in North America or in the Americas as a whole until in the very late 1500s. 1580, 1590, there were a couple of attempts. Queen Elizabeth gave a charter to Sir Walter Raleigh to try and start. And he started two colonies, one of which was quickly abandoned. They went back to England. And another, which the famous Roanoke colony, which just entirely disappeared. And nobody ever, they came back, you know, they were supposed to come back later, a year later, and their whole, it was entirely deserted, and there was nobody there, and there was no sign of where they went. And it never has been entirely solved what happened to the Roanoke colony. Although there are some pretty solid theories, but... But the first successful English colony in the New World was Jamestown, 1607. Jamestown was started as a commercial enterprise, and they were really looking for gold. After the success of the Spanish in Latin America, that's what everybody thought, that the New World was just going to be chock full of gold everywhere, and so they were going to come over and they were going to plant a colony, and they were going to go mining and looking for gold. And the result was that most of them died because there wasn't any gold, and they had a lot of goldsmiths and miners and jewelers and people like that, and they didn't have very many farmers, which is what they needed. So about half of them died in the first couple of years as a result of that poor planning. And it's notable to recognize right here when we're talking about Jamestown, as we often think of the founding of the American colonies. I think we Christians often think of the religious motivations for founding the American colonies, but they weren't all founded for that reason. There were different things going on in different places. We'll talk about Plymouth and Massachusetts Bay in a moment, but Jamestown was money. Jamestown was a commercial enterprise.
I just watched a thing on the History Channel about Jamestown, and they said that, and I thought, that's not true.
It is.
It's a liar.
Yeah.
For Vigilance of Liberty.
No. Not Jamestown. Not Jamestown. Jamestown was founded, it was an entirely commercial enterprise.
You know, back then it seems like people were more connected with, you know, needing food. I mean, we just go to the grocery store, so we don't think so much, but it seems like back then they would have thought, how are we going to get food?
Yeah.
You know, and really kind of thought through some of...
Yeah.
Did they think ships were going to bring them supplies?
Well, that's just what it was. They thought they would have enough money to pay, they would get this gold, and then they would just buy it from supply ships. Mm-hmm. They had a lot of gold, then the ships would come. If the ships come by and say, hey, get any gold? And they said, nope. So, okay, see you later. That's pretty much how that works, you know. They didn't have welfare they could apply for, you know. Yeah.
And I can't help but think, though, you know, you're juxtaposing the South American, experience. And we're better off in North America for not just having a bunch of resources.
Piles
right?
of gold,
like,
yeah.
We clearly are in a better position.
Right.
Than they are down there.
Yeah, and there are a lot of other reasons. I mean, there's Catholicism, and there's, mm-hmm. That I think is a big part of that. The relationship of the rulers to the ruled in both places was very different. But yeah, that's absolutely right. They had to get commercially viable right away or they were going to starve to death. So they had to feed themselves and they had to, make something that they could, trade to people for the things that they needed for manufactured goods from the old world and that sort of thing. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so Jamestown, it was, like I said, they were looking for gold. They were not well prepared for the farming they would need to do to survive. And many of them died in the first few years of starvation and disease. 1609, 1610, I think in particular, they call them the starving times. It was particularly bad in those years. The other thing that happened was the land that they picked, and it was the reason why the particular area of Virginia where they settled was actually relatively heavily populated by Indians. So they couldn't just settle anywhere. So the place that they selected to settle was very marginal ground, farming ground. It was swampy and not good for farming at all, and which was why there wasn't anybody else living there, because the Indians just all thought of it as a swamp that nobody wanted to live in. But they weren't thinking about farming. They were thinking about mining gold, and so they really struggled with that too. At first, their relations with the local natives of the Powhatan and Confederacy were good. And assistance from the natives was instrumental to their survival for the first few years. But the story in all of these colonies is tragically and sadly the same. That they come in and initially they have good relationships with the Indians because from the Indians' perspective, there is plenty of land and it doesn't really matter very much. And the Indians don't really think about owning land. Now, they thought about controlling territory. They would have areas that they would control. This is our tribe's territory, and your tribe can't come in here because this is where we hunt and fish and not you guys. They would think that way, but not in terms of private ownership of land. They just didn't think like that. And one of the reasons was because of their lifestyle. They did some agriculture, but not a whole lot. The Northeastern Indians did certainly more than like the Plains. The Plains Indians, you know, they didn't do any farming at all. The Northeastern Indians did some, but not a whole lot. They were hunter-gatherers. And when you're hunter-gatherers, you think more in terms of hunting grounds and not so much in terms of land you actually work and improve. They would move around from place to place. But so then as the first thing that would happen, of course, was the smallpox epidemics would go and wipe out, you know, half the population. And then so many English settlers would come over and there was just a fundamental clash in worldview and way of life between hunter-gatherers and farmers. Farmers are looking to wall in and control territory. You know, they need to protect it. They need to wall it in. They need to develop it. They're putting a lot of investment into this particular plot of land. And so they're going to want to own that plot of land because they're going to want that plot of land to serve them for the next 100 years. Hunter-gatherers don't think like that. So at first, they were friendly. They got along fine. They traded. But as the English spread and spread and spread, and there were inevitable misunderstandings and inevitable greed and inevitable abuses and inevitable revenge and grudge holding and all of that, which would inevitably lead to war. And that's how it always went with all of them, all up and down. It was, you know, you read the sources today and you know, earlier on, 100 years ago, you'd get a very kind of hagiographic story about the pilgrims, I think more so. They were all these wonderful people and noble heroes and all of that. And nowadays, they're all just horrible villains, you know, who just came in and slaughtered all the Indians. Neither one of those stories is true. And so try and tell a story. But what exactly is the truth is often pretty difficult to discover exactly because they didn't keep good records. The Indians didn't keep any records. And so we have the pilgrim stories about what happened, and we can kind of glean some truth from that. But it's pretty tough to know for sure in a lot of cases.
Now, during the, I just listened to a book on tape on custard.
And the dessert channel.
I know, the dessert channel. Relevant. No, but the author, seemed to think that a lot of it was misunderstanding. That they would have translators, and either the translators would be dishonest, or they just weren't very good translators.
Yeah.
And so there would be a lot of misunderstandings just based because the language understanding was so...
A lot of that, and not only language, and language was a big deal, yes. And that's, you know, mistranslations and communication barriers are a major reason for a lot of the wars in all of human history.
Yeah.
The other thing, though, is completely different cultural assumptions. You know, you'd go in and buy land, here's an Indian, he's there. This guy says, I'd like to buy this land. And the Indian's like, all right, whatever. You know? and you'd give him money and say, okay, now I own this land, right? And he's like, I suppose. You know? That means I can, you know, to his mind, that doesn't, you know, the idea that transferred some rights.
Yeah.
And this Indian may not even have any ability to say what any other Indians who use this land is going to do. That was very common, where people would make treaties with people who didn't actually speak for the tribe, or that there was nobody that spoke for the tribe. And so they would think they had a treaty, and then somebody else would come and raid your village, and then they broke the treaty, they betrayed, and so let's go kill them all, you know. And when it was, no, you made a treaty with these people, not those people, And anyway, there's no one figure. In a lot of these cases, there wouldn't be one. Now, the Powhatan Confederacy was different. That was a more organized, more stable, and they did have leaders. So that was a little different, but that would be often the case in these sorts of... in a lot of ways, it was the sort of inevitable. You've got population pressures. You've got tons of people coming from Europe that want to make a home. And you have... One point is that, you know, okay, so the Powhatan Confederacy occupied a chunk of land that ran from... what's now called Tidewater, the Tidewater area of Virginia, which is from the foothills down to the ocean, and that's like a 20,000 square mile area. You know, it's like 100 miles into the mountains, and it's like 200 miles down this way, right? It's a big chunk of land, right? The Powhatan Confederacy, at its height, had 20,000 people living in it. So that's 20,000 people living in this whole great big chunk of land. The Jamestown colony at its height had 6,000 people living in it, in this little thing here. Mm-hmm. Right? So you see that's not going to last, you know? There's just no way. And they did try and the Jamestown colony, like I said, they were not religious. They were not, it was the Plymouth colony that was more, the Jamestown colony was a little bit worse about. And the other thing was just the hard difficulty of controlling the colonists, you know, that, you know, you'd have, it wouldn't be so much things that the leaders as a whole would do, but this guy would go out and, you know, and steal food and harass the locals, which would lead to reprisals and so forth. Okay. So, as I said, more settlers arrived, more land began to be acquired, some bought, some not. Relations turned sour. The Indians started to realize that the large numbers of English settlers would gradually push them off their land, and they began to resist. They just didn't have any experience with this lifestyle and what it would mean for the control of the land. In their mind, they're sharing the land with a few dozen colonists or something. Yeah, they're okay with that. But by the time there are thousands, and they're walling off more and more, and they're cutting down the forests, and they're walling off the rivers, and they're controlling the territory, then the fact that they sold this land, then that starts to have very different implications to them than it did before. 1622, there was a large-scale attack and massacre by the Powhatan against the English and nearly destroyed the colony. Nearly half of the 6,000 settlers who had come to Jamestown by 1624 had died. It probably would have failed entirely, except they discovered tobacco. And they discovered that the marginal land that they had chosen did happen to be very good for growing tobacco. And they started selling tobacco in large quantities to Europe, because tobacco was becoming really profitable in Europe. And so they started selling tobacco. And that's basically how Jamestown survived, was by the cultivation of tobacco. As I said, Jamestown was not established for religious reasons. It was always Anglican. These were Anglican gentry that were given the charter. And this would set the pattern. The twin experiences of Jamestown and Plymouth would be the difference between North and South that would persist all the way through after the Civil War. The southern colonies were all Anglican colonies. The Church of England was the state church of all of the southern colonies. In the northern, it was all Congregationalist Puritans. Very, very different. And so the Anglicans were very hierarchical, very not so interested in equality or anything like that, or the rights of people as a whole. They were very interested in the individual rights of landholding citizens, the gentry, but not so concerned about everybody else. So you had very different attitudes towards You know, that led to the famous complaints of Samuel Johnson a century later that said these clamorers for freedom are the greatest drivers of the Negro in the world. You know, here these people who are all these Virginians complaining about freedom all the time, even as they owned all these slaves. Well, that showed the very different attitude. It wasn't just economic realities why they had slavery in the South and not in the North. Economic realities were part of it, but a lot of it was a very different religious experience of those in the South and the North. The South, as I said, were Church of England people, and they were not very religious at all. They were, you know, that they came over and they were mostly establishing economic colonies. And so they were, you know, adventurers, opportunity seekers, businessmen, and not a lot of really passionate religious people in the South, in the Southern colonies. The Northern colonies is a very different story.
Where were the German Reformed at this time? We were in the colonies.
No German Reformed yet.
Obviously,
the German Reformed would mostly go to Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And that really starts later in the 1600s. We're not talking about Pennsylvania here today, but Pennsylvania is founded by the Quakers and is founded with religious liberty. Mm. And that's why the German Reformed and lots of others went there, and Mennonites and lots of other groups went to Pennsylvania because they could have their own churches there. Mm-hmm. No, they couldn't in a lot of other places.
Didn't Presbyterians, a lot of them go to North Carolina? Carolina?
There were groups of Presbyterians, and that was, again, especially later, but a lot of them got imported there originally as slaves.
Oh, okay.
Or indentured servants. Although, again, I don't really have North Carolina much on the radar just yet, because North Carolina starts to get developed a little bit later. So it wasn't this the Virginia colony. Yeah, a lot of you remember the Presbyterians, so those would have been Scotch. And they were people that, in a lot of cases, got caught up in were either fleeing or got caught up in the persecution of the Presbyterians. Because remember, Presbyterianism was illegal in England after the Civil War until the Glorious Revolution of 1690. And so all through the second half of the 1600s, Presbyterians were being rounded up and shipped to they were being given the option of jail or indentured servitude in the colonies.
Huh.
And a lot of Scotch-Irish Presbyterians came to, that's how they came to the Carolinas, not by choice in a lot of cases.
Okay.
Now there were Presbyterians that immigrated, you know, as well in a lot of places, and they would, but as we'll see in a moment, the early Congregationalist colonies were not friendly to people who were not Congregational Puritans. They did not have religious liberty in their colonies. But that's Jamestown. Let's see. So as I said, it was always Anglican even during the Commonwealth years. During the Commonwealth years, remember, that's Oliver Cromwell when he's in charge in England. So there were actually two places in the world, and one of them was Virginia, and one of them was, I want to say, Barbados. Yeah, Barbados was the only places in the world where there was still an Anglican church. Because they actually maintained the Anglican church in Jamestown and in, although it was a very moderate Anglican church in Jamestown. They never did go for all the pomp and show of William Laud and all of that. But they were mostly just interested in a comfortable, you know, kind of friendly to the gentry. And like I said, they were just not very religious in Jamestown. And that really set the pattern in a lot of ways for the South. That would merit
the Bible Belt.
I was going to say, it's funny that it switched, because now the North is not so much.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. It very much switched, and if you track the development of Puritanism, you very kind of much see the reason for that. Puritanism, it's progressivism, it's city on the hill mentality, the pure society mentality, very much post-millennial. As it kind of gets emptied of theological content, becomes the modern progressive movement. There's still, you know, the modern New England progressives are every bit as Puritan and intolerant as the worst Puritans were. They just don't have any religion holding them back anymore. Now they're just...
They still want the perfect society.
They still want to perfect everything.
Yeah.
They just want it on secular terms. Yeah, exactly.
Control and,
yeah. The South, on the other hand, they've always been interested in, as in a whole, and I think it's even still probably true, they're very interested in a Christianity that's kind of very visible, but not all that challenging, you know, that maybe doesn't require too much of you in terms of, you know, now there's always your fundamentalists and always the folks that are really passionate about it. But broad Christianity in the South today, as I understand it, as you guys yourselves have told me, is very much interested in kind of public Christianity. Yeah, we're all good Christians here, but that is not one that really challenges you all that much, you know.
Yeah.
Okay. And so as a result, there was always a more hierarchical society in the Virginia colony. Very early on, there was very much a hierarchy. You had your gentry at the top, and you had your indentured servants, your workers, and then slaves down below that. And it was always a very hierarchical society. And it was southern colonies were established for economic reasons and by Anglicans, and then the southern colonies were always a more popular destination for the English gentry rather than the much more congregationalist settlers to the north. So when the son of an English noble that grew up in a great deal of comfort, you know, with other people doing all the work and he was just kind of managing, when he thinks, you know, there's not room for him in England anymore, he needs to go make his fortune in the New World, where's he going to go? He's not going to go to the north. He's going to go to the south. And he's going to get a plantation, and he's going to sit on his porch drinking mint juleps while the slaves do all the work. You know, that was very much the model. That was very much the model that you saw in this. And you see the religion, how much the religion impacts it. The Anglicanism, the very kind of comfortable, you know, like I said, moderate, not too, yeah, we're Christians, but don't make too big a deal out of that. Model in the South, as opposed to Plymouth Colony in the North.
It's interesting to look at this now, because Paul served a church in Virginia, and it was so different than the Midwest rural churches. And you know, it ties in because he was like an indentured servant, and the people who ran the mills, because it was a mill town.
Oh yeah,
you know, they were in charge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and he was upsetting the cart.
Yeah,
you know, nobody really could figure out what was going on. But now that you're saying this, it's that fits.
Well, you think of like the Dukes of Hazzard, right? I mean, I know that's, but
I
that
never watch that.
Well, you've got Boss Hogg in his nice white suit, mm-hmm. who's the town boss, right? And he just kind of tells everybody else what to do, and he's the guy that runs the place, right? You know, and then you've got the Hazards, Beau and Duke, are Scotch Irish, you know, rebels who are down there fighting against the man, the English, you know, that's very much the, you know, the dynamic that characterized the South in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And where work is something that nobody really wants to do very much, you know, that hard work is something to be avoided. And that's one thing that hierarchical societies like that create, is that hard work is something that servants and slaves do. And success in life means not having to work anymore, you know. Very different model than what you see in the North. And I think that's a big part of the reason why the South stagnated economically for so long, is because of what a slave society does to a people. In terms of culture, and I think it took the South a long time after the war. The invention of air conditioning, I understood, helped a lot. But
I heard a lecturer say the same thing about Spain, that the New World money ruined Spain.
It was the same thing.
And so in their literature, the hero is someone who can get wealth through graft and trickery. Like, he's the hero.
Yeah.
But not work. Work is not noble.
Yeah.
That's demeaning. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Plymouth Colony.
What's that? I don't see that so much.
Well, Texas,
anymore.
I would think, would be a different story.
Texas is a different story. I mean,
Texas,
like,
is a different
South
story.
As far as the South goes, Virginia is a, like, its own thing because it's D.C.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
well, anymore. I'm talking about traditionally, though. I mean, the D.C. push, that's a whole different dynamic now.
That's a different dynamic.
But you think of, like, the old South, like Virginia and North and South Carolina,
mm-hmm.
and going back before D.C. became such a big deal.
Yeah.
You know, going
yeah.
back 100 years.
Yeah.
There's that, and then there was the Deep South, Alabama, Alabama, Mississippi, mm-hmm. places like that. And there's different,
those have a very different flavor than,
And then Texas.
Ranchers and that's a
different.
And
they're
very different.
They always kind of said, they were there always kind of their own thing. They were settlers.
We were our own country.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
No one there is forgotten.
Yeah. I wish you'd always read it named that way.
Only they have Texas, their own country, and you have FFV in Virginia.
Yeah. From
the first family.
That's right.
That's right.
Okay, Plymouth. Plymouth Colony was established in 1620 by the famous Mayflower Pilgrims. They were separatists. The 1620, you'll remember our time frames. This is before the Civil War. This is 1607 was the rule of James. The 1620 is Charles and all of the things that led up to this. Led up to the 1620. If James was, I can't remember now whether it was James or Charles, but one of them, and neither one of them were friendly to Congregationalists. Congregationalism was illegal in England. So they were separatists, those who wanted to exit the Church of England entirely. And this is an important distinction. We call them Puritans, but they weren't really. Because Puritans, and we speak of a general theological perspective of Puritans, but technically Puritans were those who wanted to stay in the Church of England and purify it. So there were the Puritans, and then there were the Separatists, who didn't want to have anything to do with the Church of England at all.
They were kind of a branch of the Puritans.
If you use the terminology real technically, then they weren't Puritans, but really they were. They were a branch, as you said, a kind of a subgroup of the Puritans.
They wanted a pure church.
They were known as the Brownist migration for a good 100 years after this, and that was because there was a man named Brown, a preacher in England who preached separation from and preached against state churches, preached against denominations, preached congregationalism and separatism, and there were political ideas that went along with that, democracy and so forth, and so they were called the Brownist migration. Usually in contempt, because these were people that didn't like Brown. So they were strongly Puritan in theology, and their goal was to establish an ideal religious society. That was their goal. A truly Christian society like the world had never seen before. That was what they were after in Plymouth. It is from Plymouth that we get the city on a hill terminology, that we will be a shining city on the hill. And when that was said, I think that was a sermon by John Winthrop, I believe. But Winthrop was saying, his point was, we need to behave. we need to watch ourselves, because the world is going to be watching this experiment. We're like a city on a hill, and we need to shine the light. And that was very much that. So to establish an ideal religious society was their goal. They left England because England prohibited them from worshiping as they chose. They struggled very hard to survive the first winter after landing in Massachusetts, at what's now Plymouth, and in part because they didn't anticipate how cold the climate would be. It was a whole lot colder than they thought it was going to be. Massachusetts is on the same latitude as Madrid, Spain. and not understanding weather patterns then as well as we do now, they figured the climate would be kind of like it was in Madrid, Spain, but it was not at all. And that's because of the way that continental climates work, and wind tends to blow from the west to the east. And so when you're on the west side of a continent, then you get the warming effect from the ocean. But when you're on the east side of the colony of the continent, then you get the more continental, the colder, with greater ranges in temperature that characterizes the more central continental, like we have here, or like they have in the middle of Siberia. Those are continental climates, and so that's why that's one of the reasons why they all starved. Not because they didn't prepare, just because they didn't know what they had to prepare for. They didn't have warm enough clothes. They didn't have building materials that could stand up to that kind of winter. The first winter, most of them died not of starvation, but of exposure, just because it was so cold.
Miserable.
It was miserable. Yeah. And a lot of them died. But they did, as we know the story, there was help from local natives, especially a man named Squanto, helped them to survive. They learned how to fish and hunt in the area and how to plant corn. The Puritans were usually good about buying land from natives. And they, I think the record shows that the Puritans probably tried harder to get along with the Indians than the Jamestown colonists did. Certainly more than the Spanish did. But the same story happened anyway. The great tragedy of it was that, once again, miscommunications, bad behavior by the colonists. It has to be said, there were too many colonists that thought of these people as heathens and unworthy of fair treatment. There was that.
Christians are so prone to that.
There was undoubtedly that. But there was also, the Indians were, obviously they were who they were, and so that would be the thing, is that once things started going south, it was very difficult to ever recover, because they held grudges, and they reprised, so in their mind, if one white local settler goes out and commits some crime against the Indians, and in response, the Indians send a war party and kill three or four families, that's just how they did business. Mm-hmm. And if it was Indian tribes, they'd say, okay, you got us, all's fair, turnabout's fair play, and they'd go on with life. That's how the Indians would do it. Well, the Puritans, the English didn't do things that way. They'd organize a war and go wipe you out if you did something like that. So it was that sort of thing a lot of times that would happen. And then there was the encroachment on land, the inevitable, the expansion of the colonies as more settlers came over, more land got bought. The Indians start to realize they're getting pushed out of their traditional hunting and fishing grounds, and the epidemics that wiped out half the population as well. All those things together led to the tragedy that happened everywhere in the New World when the Europeans contacted the natives.
I hear that and I feel like, well, it's just inevitable. Like, there was nothing, it's almost like there's no fault. Broadly speaking, it's just,
I think
there was nothing. There
was no way that when you've got a North American continent, like above the Rio Grande, north of the Aztecs, mm-hmm. right, that this whole continent is occupied by, at its most, maybe 2 million people. How is that just going to stay empty forever? How is that going to get, what is it? What does it hold today? 400 million people? Mm-hmm. There is no way that it was ever reasonable that those 2 million people were going to hold down the North American continent for all of perpetuity. It just wasn't going to happen. That's when they weren't even using most of it. They were the 1%. Considered in terms of real estate wealth, they were the richest people on earth. These few people that had this huge, vast expanse of land they could just play around in and hunt and fish and murder each other sometimes. And, that's just what they did. And then in the meantime, you have these vast, teeming, crowded hordes in Europe that are looking, looking for some place to make a living and farm and have freedom. It just wasn't going to happen. I think there were plenty of individual crimes on both sides, but I think the broad story was inevitable. I don't think there's any, I don't think there was any way around it. Okay, so the hostility broke out in the Pequot War in 1637. There was a massacre of a Pequot village that was a result of that. The much worse King Philip's War took place in 1662. That was a brutal, brutal thing.
Indians,
was that? Yes, King Philip was an Indian. It was the name of an Indian, the head of a confederacy. That was his English name. He had an Indian name as well, but it's always been called King Philip's War.
Oh, okay.
There were massacres and slaughters and horrible things that happened all through those. The Europeans were just, they were not, I mean, as bad as the wars of religion were, they were just not used to the way the Indians did things, slaughters and mutilations and atrocities and slavings and, all sorts of horrible things. No mistake, there were atrocities on the colonist side as well, like the massacre of the Pequots. And there were 300. They surrounded this whole village. This was in 1637. The Puritans, the English armies surrounded this whole village. There were 300 people in there, just lit it on fire, burned it all down. Men, women, children, just killed them all. Yeah, they were, you know, it was war. It was war, and people felt like they were fighting for their survival, and they were a long way from civilization, and that's the sort of thing that happens when you're afraid for your life, you know. So ultimately, this combined with between these two wars, especially King Philip's War, combined with all the epidemics, led to the collapse of the native population in the whole region there as the English colonies continued to grow. Plymouth Colony was Congregationalist, meaning that every congregation voted in their leadership and was ultimately accountable to no one outside themselves. This was an interesting combination of things where you have a state church, but you have a state church with no authority over it, except the local congregation. The local congregation was the established church, and you had to go to that church. It was, church attendance was mandatory. There were no other churches to go to. They actually at various times tried to prevent people from living too far away from the villages so that they could make sure that they could keep an eye on everybody and that they could actually come to... Because remember, the ideal religious society is their goal here. And as in Massachusetts Bay, it was mandatory. Other religions and sects were banned. Anabaptists and Quakers would be flogged. They'd often have their ears knocked to mark them as Anabaptists. They'd have them cut, you know, to mark them as Anabaptists. And people who did not abide by the religious authority of the church would commonly be exiled. In 1660, four Quakers were hanged for defying the colony's exile order. So that there was four people that they executed because they were Quakers. And that really shocked the public conscience and led to calls for greater religious liberty. But there, you know, the old joke, I think it was Garrison Keillor's joke about the Puritans were those that left England in hopes that greater restrictions could be found elsewhere. There was a lot of truth to that, actually. But so they learned from that. You know, they thought they're going to come and they're going to have this ideal religious society, and they needed a lot of rules to make that happen. And then they saw what happened as a result. And so then they backed off of a lot of that and started granting greater religious liberty. The vote issue was a huge thing, too. And for religious reasons, because church membership was required to have voting rights. To be a voting citizen in Plymouth and in Massachusetts Bay, you had to be a member of the church. It was theoretically open to all landowning male members of the church above a certain age. But the other thing was that church membership required that one have a visible testimony of a religious conversion. And for this reason, many could not have membership in the church, even though they'd been baptized in the church, grew up in it, held to its doctrines, and had no scandals. They had to be able to give a testimony of here was the time, here was the moment, and this is what happened, and it had to be convincing. That you had to be able to tell a sufficiently convincing story that the elders of the church would say, yes, we believe that you are actually a Christian. And you had to be able to do that before you could be a member of the church.
But they didn't believe in the covenantal...
No, they were Puritans. Puritans had a very different... They were so... You know, in the context of a state
that
church...
In the 80s, though, right?
Yeah. Yeah, for a while they did. The context of the state church in England was such that there were so many nominal believers. There were so many people who were just part of the churches because they'd been baptized and they'd grown up, combined with the fact that because it was a state church, you couldn't really do any discipline. You couldn't kick people out because it was all politics. It was, you know, if the state church is under the control of the government and the government doesn't want to have a lot of fights and fusses, you know, it really had to be something super serious, and usually it had to be a political offense before anybody could ever get excommunicated. So discipline was really lax under the state churches in England. The Puritan approach to that thing was to really preach at people, and it got developed so that you could only really be a Christian if you'd had this experience, if you'd had this conversion moment. They were wrestling with the fact of telling how to wake people up out of their slumber, how to wake people up out of their nominalism. I think they took the wrong approach, but that was the approach they took.
It's a real problem, but the response...
Yeah, it was a real problem, for sure.
Not biblical.
And in a lot of ways, I think they were doing the best that they could in the context of a state church that they couldn't do anything about.
Because the answer was no state church.
Yeah, the answer was to disconnect the church from the state so that you can do real church discipline.
Yeah.
So that you can rid the church of those nominal people, you know, who have no real profession and even have no, you know, they're just going through the motions and are still living in unrepentant sin in lots of ways.
So it's actually what the state schools are running into, that because they have compulsory education,
yeah,
the kids
thing.
Who don't belong there are bringing... They ruin education for everyone else.
Right.
It makes a mockery of the education system.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's the same thing.
Yeah. Do you think they, because you had to be a church member to vote, do you think they kind of, it didn't work as well as they wanted it to because you had to be a church member to vote?
Well, it didn't work very well because a lot of the people who lived and worked there were really mad about the fact that ostensibly here was this democratic, egalitarian society, but in fact there was only a small elite that was controlled by the church leadership who could actually vote at any time. So a lot of people who lived and worked there had no voting rights. They had no... and so that made a lot of people really mad, and that's what eventually led to the change. Led to the different approach. But what they did first was it led to what was known as the halfway covenant, about halfway down that second paragraph. Baptized members could be regarded as church members and could vote, even though they were not considered full members and could not participate in the Lord's Supper. So what the halfway covenant was it was saying, if you grew up in the church, if you've been baptized, if you had no scandal, and confess belief in the doctrines of the church, then you could be a part of what they call the halfway covenant. You could be kind of a halfway member. And what that meant is, basically, that you could vote. But you still couldn't take communion, and you were still not considered a full member of the church. That was their solution to that, which sort of solved the civil problem. It did not solve the religious problem. So they could not participate in the Lord's Supper. Agitation at this compromise was a big part of what led to the Great Awakening a century later in the 1730s. So Solomon Stoddard's approach, that was Jonathan Edwards' father-in-law, his approach was the halfway covenant. He was a big advocate of that. Jonathan Edwards thought that the halfway covenant was a horrible solution and disagreed, but his solution was, let's get people that experience they need. And so let's start preaching blood and thunder. Let's start preaching sinners in the hand of an angry God. Let's preach at them their sin in a very dramatic and emotional style that the people were not used to. This was a new thing to have this very powerful kind of dramatic preaching. Preaching before that was more kind of doctrinal lectures and less hitting them with their sins all the time. So it's kind of a new... And that's what very much led to the Great Awakening, is what was called the new measures were adopted in a lot of different places.
So that's where the seeds of our modern emotional
revivalism,
heavy worship services.
I thought Jonathan Edwards was not dramatic. Very boring.
No. No, he wasn't. The people would swoon and cry and faint at his sermons, and the monologue and all of that. I have been led to believe that that is kind of a story. That's kind of not actually really true. That he was actually he didn't have a. Well, I shouldn't say because I'm not a scholar of Jonathan Edwards, but. But certainly it was what they called the new measures, and the new measures, and Jonathan Edwards was the leader of it, was the very powerful, dramatic style of preaching that people were unused to. A century later, John Williamson Nevin would write a tract called, and he was an RCUS guy, actually, a German Reformed guy, who wrote a book called The Anxious Bench. And there he very much... contrasted the two different approaches, and he leads it all back to Jonathan Edwards. So does Charles Hodge. Now there were precursors. There were pietists, and there were certainly precursors. John Wesley around the same the same period of time in England, but George Whitfield. Jonathan Edwards came in touch with George Whitfield, heard him. That's kind of what got Jonathan Edwards going in a lot of ways. But between the two approaches of the anxious bench meant that bench, that was up in front where you'd go and sit and wait and have that great experience. it's the equivalent of an altar call. It was with, you know, there was the old equivalent of an altar call. And on the other hand, catechizing was the other approach. And Nevin's point was that catechizing is the historical approach, that you bring people along gradually. And you're not looking for that big dramatic moment. You're looking for line upon line and precept upon precept and bringing people gradually to a point of greater and greater knowledge that not everybody's going to have. Most people are not going to have that big single moment when they... You know, some people do. You know, you've got your Paul on the road to Damascus, but you've also got your Timothys that knew the scriptures as a youth, you know.
As one who was taught, you know, from my youth,
yeah.
I still had experiences, but they weren't, or I didn't believe, and then I believed.
Right,
was,
right.
My sin would cause pain in my life, and
yeah.
that would force me to God.
And you'd have,
but I had tools. I already had the tools. I had been taught
yeah.
the gospel, so I knew where to go.
And they were breakthroughs,
sin,
but ones
yeah.
that are built on a lot of
yeah,
learning
exactly.
and a lot of instruction, yeah. Yeah.
And so they weren't, so they lasted, too. I felt like I had friends who would go up to the altar call all the time.
Right.
As opposed to learning and growing, but just
yeah.
going back to sin and back to sin and the altar call. And
so I'm not, you know, we're not going to talk a lot about the Great Awakening, but I guess suffice it to say is personally I'm not a big fan. I think that it, you know, I think like guys like Whitfield and Edwards were fine, godly Christian men who were responding to the circumstances they understood it. And no doubt there were a lot of legitimate conversions and things that happened at that time. But I think it ultimately bore very bad fruit in America. The Second and Third Great Awakenings and Charles Finney and all of that stuff especially all grows out of this.
Charles Finney was the 1800s, wasn't he?
Yeah. He's more associated with.
That's the Third Great Awakening.
Because John
Charles Finney was the Second Great Awakening. Yeah, early 1800s, I believe. The Third Great Awakening is usually what they talk about in the late 1800s, and that is a lot of. I really ultimately get the Pentecostal movement out of that. Great deal of enthusiasm and a lot of little weird. Well, the Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses come out of that, saints too, and the Seventh Day Adventists and a lot of folks like that.
Close in history for me to know it had a name already.
yeah. It's the Third Great Awakening. It's, people don't talk about that as much, but yeah, that was another series of revivals like this.
I think there was a revival in the 60s and 70s among the hippies.
The Jesus people.
Yeah. Perhaps so.
I mean, there's just a lot of us.
No, I know a lot, for sure.
At that time, and then it didn't happen again.
Yeah. Now, early on, there was not much attempt to evangelize the natives until John Eliot in 1646. It was odd, you know, and it's been, you know, on the seal of Plymouth Colony, there is an Indian on the seal. There's an Indian with a scroll over his head saying, "Come and help us," like the Macedonian, you know, dream that Paul had. And yet, despite that, they made almost no attempt to evangelize the Indians at all for the first 25 years or so that they were there. Very little. And it's always been kind of debated why exactly that is. But John Eliot, in 1646, he was a preacher there that began working on a Bible translation in Algonquin. And he finished it in 1663. He also produced a catechism, and his work led to the conversion of thousands of natives. They were known as praying Indians, and they had their own villages. They had villages of praying Indians, is what they were called. Sadly, war and other factors led to the destruction of the many settlements of praying Indians that were established. How all that happened, there's a lot of, you know, I read accounts of betrayal by the settlers, but not a whole lot of specifics. Some of it was, it seems that when war broke out, King Philip's War and so forth, a lot of the settlers became very suspicious of even the converted Indians and made them relocate. But a lot of it was also that the Indians saw the praying Indians as on the other side, and so they kind of got caught in the middle, it seems like. Relations, as I said, between the English and the natives were usually tragic. It's a very different way of life, compounded by greed, suspicion, and grudge holding, usually destroyed whatever goodwill there was at first. Some natives assimilated into English culture. There's no doubt about that, that there was a lot of intermarriage, that there was a lot of Indians that just became part of the... and as I understand, even the American dialect and the way that the American English evolved was affected in large part by the Indian accent. The way that Indians spoke English was a big part of what caused the shift in the American way of speaking as opposed to the English way of speaking. So there were a lot that just assimilated. There were a lot that moved south and west that continued their way of life, but in other places. The colonial authorities tried to manage relations, but too many settlers acted outside the law, and too many viewed the natives as heathen and undeserving of fair treatment. Very briefly, Rhode Island. Rhode Island is significant because it was founded by Roger Williams and a group of his followers, exiled from Plymouth Plantation in 1636 for advocating for freedom of religion. Roger Williams did not think there should be a state church. He was a Congregationalist Puritan, although later on he ends up becoming convinced of the Baptist position. But Rhode Island thus became the first of the colonies in America with no established churches and with complete toleration for any religious view. He said he would even tolerate a Jew or a Turk. Now, there were very few Turks on the ground at the time, and so that was the safe thing to say, but that's what he said anyway. Williams became convinced of the Baptist position on infant baptism after being exiled, and Rhode Island thus became an early home for Baptists, as well as a great many others who were not welcome in the stricter Puritan colonies. Williams was also an early advocate for native evangelization, though not as successful as Eliot would be.
I remember Williams learning a Beck of history. Williams was a big hero. I remember them.
Yeah. And, you know, I think he has a lot to commend him for. I'm a good Reformed guy, but I think the Anabaptists had the right of that particular issue of freedom of religion. You know, I'm definitely on board with that. So that was just not a, I mean, there were the early signs of it, you know, in Geneva and in Cromwell and in some other places, but it was really the Anabaptists that championed that position early on. And I think they ended up definitely winning the day on that and for the good of the church as a whole. I mean, now, ironically, almost worldwide, the Anabaptist position on that is the default position of the Christian church virtually everywhere. Even the Catholics have pretty much come around to it. You know, although if they ever gained, but I mean, even in the places where they have sway, even in the places like in South America where the Catholics are overwhelmingly the dominant faith, they generally don't persecute other churches anymore, you know.
Funny, as a Lutheran, I never heard of Rutherford.
Yeah.
Not part of your particular discussion.
It's the curriculum produced by Pensacola, Florida, the Bob Jones
Baptist,
rival. Yeah, the Baptist.
Fundamentalist Baptists.
Are raised reading their histories.
Lutherans, I believe, early settled in Delaware. It was a Swedish, Delaware was, a Swedish Lutheran colony. Hmm. And there were a lot of Lutherans in Pennsylvania early on. But the big wave of Lutherans came later, and they went further west into the Minnesota, the Dakotas, Wisconsin, places like that. Anything else? Any questions? Or?
That was interesting.
Well, let's close in prayer. Gracious Heavenly Father, we thank you for your grace and mercy to us. We thank you for your providence and all that you've done to preserve your church and advance your gospel. We thank you for the heritage and history we have. And even as we see there are many failings and weaknesses, yet you did your work through them and continue to propagate and preserve your church. And we thank you for that. We pray that it would continue to show us grace and work even through our weaknesses to do your will in this world, Lord. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.